everyone. Welcome to another OneLiner.com podcast. I am Craig, and with me, as always, are Drew.
Hello.
And Scott.
Well, hello.
I did it back to front this time. I normally do Scott first, but I'm just feeling that crazy. We've got some stuff to talk about tonight. Thought you might like to hear it. So without further ado, let us crack on. What would I do if I had a hammer? It's the Do you see where this one's going? Well, if I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning. I'd hammer in the evening. I would not throw my hammer away. I would keep my hammer, Thor, not throw it away. Why did you throw your hammer away, you dick? So then, Thor, latest in the Avengers setup, directed by Kenneth Branagh and starring Chris Hemsworth as a titular Norse god banished to Earth to live among mere mortals after calling his dad a knob. Probably. His dad is Anthony Hopkins. Natalie Portman also stars. It all looks a bit 80s hair metal to me. Drew?
Yes, well, first of all, obviously you've not seen it because Thor doesn't throw his hammer away. His dad does.
If I say Thor threw his hammer away, that's good enough. So did he call his dad a dick and he threw his hammer away? No, a knob, sorry. It was a knob, wasn't it? I've had it's enough knob. Of your insolent son. There goes your hammer.
You're a knob.
You're a knob, Odin. I'm off.
Keys my hammer. I'll set Natalie Portman on you. Yeah, so Thor calls his dad a knob and Anthony Hopkins throws his hammer away.
Yes. Well, he doesn't actually call him a knob at this point. That would be more amusing than what does happen. Thor just basically disobeys his dad Odin's orders.
No, he didn't wash the car.
No, he didn't wash the car, didn't take the rubbish out, didn't tidy his bedroom.
Oh, Dad.
No more Xbox for you. And what's that outside? Oh, it's your hammer. Right out the pram.
Having caused his dad to become so miffed. Yeah, so anyway, young Thor's been a naughty boy, and Odin says, right, Sonny Jim, I'll be having that hammer off of you. Takes away his power as well, condemns him to spend the rest of the time until he's learned his lesson on Earth, and he promptly gets sent back to Earth in a thunderstorm and lands on the side of Natalie Portman's car.
Nice.
And after that, it's a fairly simple job for him.
Does he have a mental breakdown, or is it just you?
It's just me.
This is why I like throwing them out to you, Drew. The thought of preparation shines through.
Yes, it's great. The hamster stopped running. Hold on, let me poke it.
You have a hamster?
Something's got to turn the wheel in my head, right?
Oh, right, okay. I thought literally you had a hamster. Does Thor have a hamster? His dad could just have taken that off him.
But he does visit a pet store.
Cool.
He could have bought a hamster had he so desired, but he chose not to. So, next film.
Presumably because having thrown his hammer away, Anthony Hopkins also didn't give him any pocket money that week. Scott, clear this up for us.
I'm sorry, I could go on.
All right, okay. Please do. It's one of those, isn't it? It's one of those.
Yeah, so having landed on Earth, sans hammer, Thor has to try and make do with a mortal life, and all at the same time, up in Asgard, his brother Loki's causing all sorts of mayhem, and trying to start the war with the Frost Giants. No, apparently I couldn't go on.
Starting the war.
Meanwhile, Thor's at B&Q testing out other hammers.
Starting a war with the Frost Giants. Saturday night up the toon. Does Thor's hammer have a Stanley knife sellotaped to the top of it? In a tongs styley. Aye, so let's get down to the nitty-gritty here. Scott, is Thor any good?
Not particularly. I don't think it's particularly dreadful, but it's, in common with most of the recent comic book adaptations, it's kind of middling. I thought it was odd that Kenneth Branagh was directing this. It doesn't seem to be his sort of usual bag. suppose in retrospect I can kind of see where it's coming from. Yeah. There's a few themes in here that are really more taken more from Hamlet than Iron Man, although Hamlet doesn't have Claudius setting a monstrous robot on the prince, so maybe not entirely taken from the canon of Shakespeare, but
there's a sort of a flavour of the Bard to it, isn't there?
Yeah, so all the parts set in Asgard, where Thor's younger brother's kind of making a power grab and trying to take the throne from Odin and usurp him and yada yada yada, it's kind of mildly interesting. It's certainly what you wouldn't normally see in a comic book film, and it's aesthetically quite pleasing in there. At least it's certainly more imaginative than most of the comic book stuff. The problem is that's about two sets, and the rest of it's set in the most bland of possible New Mexican towns or a desert, and looks pretty boring in comparison.
I think towns stretching it somewhat. Basically, it's got a diner, a crossroads, and some sand.
And a pet shop.
And a pet shop, yes.
Come and get your snakes here. Snakes, not much else. Oh, I do have a hamster.
Briefly, until the snakes got it.
Gosh darn it.
So it's got pretty decent performances throughout. I don't really have any bones to pick for them. They're about as believable and likeable as you'd want for this kind of thing. Hemsworth gives a pretty decent turn, and his sort of, wow, I'm still a god, honest, kind of an acronym sort of early on are kind of amusing. But the problem is that Thor himself is a bit of a dick. It's supposed to be a story of his personal redemption and, you know, his growing maturity and responsibility and yada, yada, yada. But the problem is when you're first introduced to him, he's just so immature and irredeemable that it's kind of difficult to really care about anything. He's the sort of person that should really be brought up more in more war crime charges at Hague rather than anything else.
You've also picked up one of the points I had too, Scott, that Chris Hemsworth is quite likeable as Thor later on. You're just maybe a bit of a buffoon, but you do have a bit of a problem rooting for a character when one of the very first things you see him do is murder someone. He's having a conversation in the Frost Giant's own land, and Thor murders a Frost Giant in the middle of a conversation after the Frost King won't tell him how they entered Asgard. He doesn't kill him in a fight, doesn't kill him defending himself, he just murders him, straight out murders him, and we're supposed to like this character for the rest of the film.
He had it coming.
But he's good, he's a god, you see.
The gods can't murder, partly.
No.
They had it coming because they're not gods.
Diplomatic immunity! Just been revoked.
What else? The rest of it? It doesn't really do an awful lot to stand out. The 3D's dreadful. Yeah, it's
let me guess, does he throw his hammer out of the screen quite a lot?
Actually, no, it's the sort of 3D that's just, there's no point to it being in 3D. It makes so little use of it, and what use it does is so badly handled that it's just better not to be bothered existence. With it.
Yeah, it's not a huge step above the sort of pop-up book stuff of Clash of the Titans. It's really very much like that for most of it when you notice it at all.
Mm, boo.
I mean, overall, I mean, it's, as a sort of slice of escapism, it's okay. I mean, it's just so unremarkable in a genre that's completely oversubscribed with this sort of thing already. I just don't see any justification for it unless you're really desperate for some comic book action of a night. There's nothing to differentiate itself from anything else. And unless you are a massive Thor fan, and I didn't even know there was a Thor comic book until a poster started to appear for this, then I don't think you're going to get anything useful out of it.
No, it's kind of worrying too that there's so many more of these to come. As even before the Avengers films, setting up all the different characters for it. And I would agree with most of what Scott had said there too. I think perhaps I enjoyed it even slightly less than he did. And there's certainly humour in it. You know, Thor's demand for a horse and a pet shop and his subsequent intention to ride the suggested alternative, as well as the genial buffoonery of the Warriors 3 are good examples. You know, and after a slow start in which he's kind of straightened by the ludicrous trappings and speech of Asgard, in which I reckon Anthony Hopkins and his gold arm are some sort of uber power ranger, Hemsworth himself quickly becomes quite likable, but as I said, he's a murderer, so it's like you don't want to like him. And that's sort of, it's undermined by that anyway.
Just ask Lars von Trier, though. He'd tell you it's all right to sympathise with a murderer.
But it's all right, it's not Mel Gibson. It's a part of his defence.
Yes.
Most of the rest I found just sort of disappointed. It's really bland, pointless. It doesn't have a particularly interesting story to tell. I'd say Scott's right that the sets in Asgard have a bit more originality than you might often see. He's that I still didn't like them though. So
I mean, from the trailer, it all looked a bit Flash Gordon to me. But
yeah, that's a reference a lot of reviewers have made, and it's kind of legitimate. Actually, the whole Asgard thing is really kind of campy and over the top. But there's no.
So really, is it basically just a sort of perfunctory outing in order to set this character up for the Avengers film?
Yeah, I think so. I just found the rest of it disappointed too. Mostly cast Renee Russo. You don't know whether she can do anything good. She's in it for about 3 scenes, so she's underused the point of it being pointless or being there. Stellan Skarsgård just sort of floats around. His heart's not really into the role. Tom Hiddleston, who plays Thor's brother Loki, is just unconvincing and unengaging as a film's villain. There isn't still much point to the film at all. And also, I just do wish they had reallocated some of the $150 million budget from CGI to purchasing new hardware, because there's this really odd preponderance of slanty shots that add nothing artistically, so must surely be explained by tripods with one wonky leg.
Scott, any redeeming qualities?
Well, redeeming suggests that it's irredeemable. I don't think it goes that far into the negative. I just think it's there. It's nothing particularly special one way or the other. So, I wouldn't damn it or anything like that, but I just can't give you any particularly cogent reason for going and seeing it.
Yeah, and I would add one final note to anybody that does decide they have to see it, perhaps they're looking forward to the Avengers and want to know everything before, something like that. If you do, you'll know by now, probably, that there's an after-credits sequence, as all of these Marvel films seem to have. Do not stay. The credits are about 12-15 minutes long, and the bit that happens afterwards is utterly, utterly pointless. If you must find out, just see if you can find a clip on YouTube, but do not waste your time waiting in a cinema for 12 minutes to see Samuel L. Jackson open a box.
Oh, deal or no deal. Luc Besson seemed entirely content to cock about on producer duties for a while there, birthing into the world such timeless fucking gems as The Transporter, Transporter 2, Transporter 3, Transporter 4, Transporter 5, Transporter 6, Taken, Transporter 7, District 13, Transporter 8, District 13 Ultimatum, and Transporter 9. Not that he's given up on producing, mind. He has producer, not executive producer, but producer credits on 7 films this year alone. No doubt he's still beavering away on an original idea for Transporter 10, so lay your dreamy little head on your pillow easily tonight. Bizarrely at some point, though, Besson seems to have hit his head and remembered briefly what it was he used to do, which is to say shout at technical people and aim cameras towards actors. This he has done, with the end result being Extraordinary Adventures of Adele Blanc-Sec, a tale of early 20th century adventure in the vein of Indiana Jones, but a little bit more Gallic, starring the impossibly beautiful Louise Bourgeois as our hero. It's not often that such a quintessentially European film gets a broad release, but is it because Besson is still at the fringe of marquee names, or is it because it's any good? Scott?
It's probably a combination of the two, but it's I enjoyed the Extraordinary Adventures of Adele Blanc-Sec very much, which is perhaps a surprise to me, given Besson's recent record. I had absolutely no idea what to expect going into it. It's based, again, as with everything, on a comic book these days.
What?
My knowledge of Franco-Belgian comics is approximately zero. So I guess it was at least news to me. Adele herself is an investigative journalist, although she's more like a Victorian-era Tomb Raider or Lara Crofty type person. She's rummaging round a pyramid when we were introduced to her, in search not of gold, but a physician. A long-dead mummified doctor, which would seem strange were it not for Adele's mate Professor Esperandu back in Paris, whose psychic powers have just hatched and unleashed a pterodactyl over the skies of Paris.
As one this does.
This draws the attention of the police, pressured by higher-ups to track down and deal with this flying irritant by any means possible. This could cause issues for Esperandu, who's still telepathically linked with the bird, and would not react well to the death of it. So Adele has to help deal with this distraction to allow the professor to get on with his real task, reanimating this Egyptian mummy so he can operate on Adele's sister, who's been in a coma since a freak tennis accident. This isn't what you'd expect from your average comic book adaptation. Certainly, a quick glance at my esoteric-ometer shows a full spectrum what-the-fuck. It's certainly, however, imaginative, it's absorbing and it's entertaining. There's rich, fun characters and it's a great sense of adventure throughout. Certainly not perfect, it's a shade too long, maybe 20 minutes or so. It spends a little too long introducing enemies of sorts and then not really doing anything more interesting with them, and then for the most part just kind of forgetting about them. I get the sense that's more trying to set things up for the sequel than deliberate content padding, but it still just feels like it shouldn't be there. It feels like a bit of a waste of time. This has something of an effect on the conclusion. The film sort of very clearly ends, but then just keeps going for their 20 minutes, mainly to set up the next film, and then it just stops, which is a kind of ham-fisted way of dealing with things.
Ham-fisted? I think you'll find it's Besson touch.
From the mind of Luc Besson. So this apparently cost 31 million euros to make, which isn't exactly pocket change, but it does look a lot better than you'd probably expect for that price tag. It certainly looks a hell of a lot more extravagant than Thor does at a fraction of the cost. The CG in it might not be exactly industry-leading, but it's charming enough, and there's enough character in it to sort of let it get by the odd moments of shonkiness. But the real standouts are the sort of the sets and the costume design, which are occasionally spectacular and really less than great. Louise Bourgeon proves to be feisty and charming as a lead character, and for what, as best as I can gather to be her first major acting performance, does a pretty good job. Her drive and determination keeps this shaggy dog story on a short leash. Ha ha, you see what I did there? Dogs, leashes, ha. And it does seem to be like, it's a sort of tale that could quite easily just get away and just go become completely insane, and it sort of manages to stay relatively grounded, which does make it a hell of a lot more enjoyable. This has been hailed as something of a return to form for Luc Besson, and I can suppose I see the point given his penchant for producing boneheaded action films and Jason Statham vehicles of late. This is the most unique and the best thing that he's had his name attached to in, what, 15 years? And it certainly deserves to find an audience. Were it not for the typically French gratuitous flash of tits in one scene, it'd probably be the best family-friendly adventure I've seen this year. But as it stands, it's still a very likeable and charming flick, and I'm very fond of it.
Excellent news. Drew, I hear she used to be a weather girl or something.
Who?
Louise Bourgeon.
Did she?
Apparently. I don't know. I'm sure I heard that somewhere.
That's nice.
Yeah. One wonders what the lovely Kate Hudson makes of her career arc. Something Borrowed sees her cast out of type and well outside of her comfort zone in a romantic comedy about a girl who falls for her best friend's fiancé. That, friends, is some next level shit. Scott.
It's certainly shit. A chick lit based rom-com. You can perhaps guess this was not my choice of film on the trip to the cinema. Especially with a perfectly good Takashi Miike film running next door.
Oh no!
So Rachel White, played by Jennifer Godwin, is a lawyer, recently turned 30 and plagued with the insecurities of a single 30-something that all single 30-somethings have in rom-coms. Biological clock, left on the shelf, blah 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 blah.
AIDS.
She's acting as maid of honour for her best friend Darcy, the inestimable Kate Hudson, although it's complicated somewhat by Rachel's long-standing attraction to Darcy's fiancé Dex, played by Colin Egglesfield. And there is absolutely no point going any further into the plot because you can write it yourself on the basis of having seen any rom-com at all. So this is a sort of movie that's going to live or die by the characters and their interactions, and Something Borrowed falls flat on its face. The actors are doing a reasonable enough job, to be fair, but the script calls for an unsustainable level of suspension of disbelief regarding the characters' personalities and their relationships. Darcy's supposed to be fun and lively, and she's actually just insufferably egotistical and mostly drunk. She's very annoying, and it seems to be there's only the slenderest of chances she'd ever be able to form lasting relationships with anyone, but in particular the staid, sensible types of Dex and Rachel. Those two characters don't pass the sniff test either. They both oscillate between impossibly perfect, then ridiculously impassive, and neither are particularly sympathetic. The only remotely likeable character is played by The Office's John Krasinski, and that's only because as the film lumbers towards its final act, he's the only one calling people out on how pathetic they're being. Mechanically, it's clunky, with some of the least subtle establishing shots of London outside of recent Woody Allen films, showing as it does Big Ben, then Parliament, then Tower Bridge, then the London Eye, in a way that suggests the second unit just wanted a sightseeing tour. The absolute best I can say about the film is that it's so massively generic and so studiously avoids any hint of controversy or individuality or anything that would give this a voice of its own that it's generally bland and inoffensive rather than downright unpleasant. However, it's the film's very bland inoffensiveness that annoys me the most about it, in its attempts to avoid sticking its head above the parapet in any respect, in its attempts to avoid provoking any negative reaction, that itself provokes my negative reaction. It's a film that does nothing, it says nothing, and so it means nothing. It's a film that's only ambition is to exist for 2 hours during date night, and that's the most offensive thing of all. In a cinematic landscape that's crying out for innovation, for anything remotely new, something borrowed, perhaps fittingly enough, provides nothing new and everything borrowed from the ghosts of previous films that also had nothing new to say.
Now,
it's not recommended.
Your kidnapper, as I shall refer to the person on this particular outing, did they enjoy the film?
They would not say that it is a good film. No.
Right, okay.
It lasts for 2 hours.
There's hope then.
And is not utterly, utterly dreadful. It is just empty.
Did your kidnapper express sufficient remorse for their crime?
Yes.
In that case, net gain, zero. All that's happened is you've lost 2 hours of your life. At least I know that your kidnapper, potentially, has taste in films. Because I have a sneaking suspicion that if someone who shall not be named were to kidnap me and take me to this film, I have a horrible, horrible feeling that that person would probably enjoy this film. I would receive no apology, and there would be at least a fortnight's worth of stony silence in my house. That's all I will say. Hannah is one of those films that piques interest from the outset. A strong cast, interesting story with provocative central protagonist, and a director in Joe Wright working out of type in a genre you wouldn't expect, it's the tale of a teenage assassin raised in social seclusion by her father to be an infinitely adaptable killer and who is set loose to eliminate a target. Oh yes, I likes me the sound of that. Drew.
Yes, so, Hannah, young girl, living with her father in snowy forest, sorry, not always snowy, but snowy forest in the north of Finland. She's being trained to be some sort of mad killer, insane martial arts skills, hunter, stealthy, hand-to-hand combat, etc.
Pain in the arse, basically.
But not knowing a great deal about her history, given this rather mysterious errand in the end to hunt down some women because it's either kill or be killed, apparently. She makes a decision she wants to go back to civilization to confront this woman, leaves her father, and off she goes towards Germany with a rather circuitous route. So as she then travels through North Africa to Europe, which is a very circuitous route from Finland, to make a rendezvous with her father.
She needs a new sat-nav.
Yes. Apparently, geography wasn't part of her training in the cabin.
No.
In the woods. So she's now got to work her way from North Africa through France to Berlin to make a rendezvous with her father after... rendezvous with her father. Finish that sentence there. And she's got sort of mad martial arts skills, which she can just turn on.
Oh, hang on. They were insane a minute ago. Now they're mad.
Political correctness gone mad, isn't it?
It is. It's martial arts gone mad.
Yes. You can turn on these mad skills right away, take down several bigger and stronger people than she is, as she is constantly being pursued by CIA hitmen. And all the time, she's trying to find out about her past. So it would be rather lazy to compare this to The Bourne Identity, but it's quite like The Bourne Identity with a teenager. It doesn't have much of a plot. There's something mysterious in the girl's background. She wants to find out this evil woman who's a fairly high person in the CIA wants to kill her father, and there's a lot of fighting. Is it good though? I would have to say no. I mostly found it dull. It's kind of interesting. It's not like films you get that often. It's something Scott commented on when we saw it in the cinema too, that it's kind of nice that films like this are being made to just wish they were better. It's massively hamstrung by its casting, because every time it might just be impossible to get into the swing of it, you know, when you can be entertained by Hannah's skill and just sit back and enjoy as a sort of action film. Suddenly Kate Blanchett will appear and she's utterly, utterly woeful. I mean, you've seen Kate Blanchett being bad, but never this bad. If she'll appear, or Tom Hollander will appear, and the whole lot atmosphere is shattered, though character and not casting is likely the bigger problem for Tom Hollander's character, Isaacs. Isaac is an effete, bleached blonde, shell suit wearing nightclub owner with a penchant for transsexuals, who also happens to be a CIA hitman with a couple of skinhead neo-Nazi goons at his side.
Nice work if you can get it.
It's not surprising at all that when you first encounter Tom Hollander in his nightclub, Scott felt compelled to turn to me and say, right, is this happening? Because it's really, really weird and trippy. I mean, there are some things like it, but there are some nice action sequences in hand-to-hand combat, and Saoirse Ronan is certainly earnest, and she makes the character kind of believable for all that it's a bit silly. Eric Bana is, well, silly accent, but he's reasonably compelling and he's likeable enough. But that Kate Blanchett is abysmal. Tom Hollander is a weird drug trip, I think. No, so I can't think of anything more to say because I just didn't enjoy it very much. And
Scott, did you look upon it more favourably?
Well, it's a film I really want to like more than I can really justify. There's elements to it I like. I mean, I think apart from the universally wonky accents, I don't think it's particularly badly acted from anyone. I thought Kate Blanchett's all right. It's just her accent's much worse than all the others. The characters are sympathetic, and it's probably more believable than you'd expect given the nature of the beast. It's well paced, it's punchy, the action's pretty well handled by Joe Wright, who obviously isn't particularly used to this sort of thing, but I think that works quite well. The soundtrack from the Chemical Brothers fairly pounds along and it fits quite well, but it's just, I mean, it's not often that I wish a film had reined itself in and not taken such risks and gone to such extremes, but it's just pushing the envelope a bit too hard, and it kind of pokes a hole in it and Paul starts kind of dribbling out. It just pushes everything too far. The plot by itself is high concept enough, and by high concept I mean silly by itself, that it didn't need to be just embellished at every turn with additional just quirkiness all over the line, you know, from the German hitman and the skinhead cronies and this dude in an amusement park and all these other little flourishes that just it goes from being quirky to willfully obscure. It feels almost like it's trying to become a cult favourite by proxy, just by, you know, throwing the students will like this, tap, 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 and put that kind of, these kind of elements in just to sort of give it a bit more commercial appeal in the long run rather than because it fits the film, if you know what I mean. The film takes risks, and on an ideological level, I can support that. You need all the risks you can get. Witness Something Borrowed. It's certainly far more an interesting film than something so generic as either of the two films I just spoke about so far. I don't find it unenjoyable, and it's a long way from boring, certainly, but it's just far too odd to be embraced. It's interesting, but I just really can't recommend it. It's more of theoretical interest for the sake of it, rather than because it's actually a genuinely good film or anything like that. I've certainly spent far worse hours in a cinema, but I couldn't really recommend it to anyone.
God damn it, you guys have taken the edge off my day. I was quite looking forward to seeing this, actually. You Will Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger is one of those ensemble affairs where I'm sure everyone involved was there just to relish the opportunity of working with everyone else involved. Scott, discuss.
I concur. The latest Woody Allen film that hit our shores is so forgettable that I completely forgot I'd seen it when we did our last podcast, which perhaps tells you all that you need to know about it. If you're looking for more details, well, I'll try my best. Most of this comes from Wikipedia, so if it is wrong, then, you know, blame them, not me.
I was going to say that and I couldn't be bothered with a sort of plot recap myself because it just seemed rather
It's all very character-driven. So you've got Naomi Watts as Sally approaching the end of her tether. Her increasingly self-obsessed father, Alfie, played by Anthony Hopkins, is taken on himself to recapture his youth, which means divorcing Helena, his wife, played by Gemma Jones, sets himself up with a bachelor pad more suited to a 20-something, and marries a high-class escort, Charmaine, played by Lucy Punch. Charmaine's brass eyes is greater than her IQ. Meanwhile, Sally's husband, Roy, played by Josh Brolin, is engaged in a struggle with his difficult second novel, the novel thus far winning. Most of the time when he should be writing, he's staring goo-goo-eyed at the neighbour across the courtyard, Dia, played by Frida Pinto, and those two will soon embark on an affair. Roy has a love-hate-hate relationship with Helena, no doubt in part because the couple must rely on Helena to help pay the rent. Sally's tempted to get on board the affair train herself, lusting after her boss at the art gallery, Greg, played by Antonio Banderas. However, because she's more of a loosely bound selection of unwarranted neuroses than a character, she's not going to act on her feelings. Things start rolling to a head once Helena starts visiting a fortune teller, Crystal, played by Pauline Collins, for advice. At the heart, this is a film about delusions and the mess that they make if you follow them to their extremes. Alfie's deluding himself with the notion, if you'll pardon the age-old canard, that you're only as young as the woman you feel, and I trust I'm not subverting any of your expectations by revealing that things do not go well for him and his young trophy wife. There's no character here that isn't deluding himself at some level, in whatever way they choose to cope with the grim realities of modern life. Everyone seems to basically get what they deserve, and that doesn't work out well for any of them. For what I'm sure was nominally pitched as a comedy, there's a refreshingly miserable ending for everybody, apart from the characters who are deluding themselves all the way into mental health problems, sometimes after credit rolls. Whether that's a good idea in a comedy is another matter entirely. You can't fault the cast. It's as good an ensemble cast as you can hope for, and everyone's doing what they're asked of. It's just a case where what they're being asked to do isn't really up to scratch, and certainly not the level that they're capable of achieving. Most of the characters barely scrape into two dimensions, and none of them seem particularly comfortable with the words Woody Allen's stuffing into their mouths. I was about to say that this is above the low watermark set by Cassandra's Dream, but that can't be entirely accurate. Cassandra's Dream didn't set a low watermark, because it was so bad it banished all water around it to this land of wind and ghosts. It's probably more accurate to say that You Will Meet a Tall Dark Stranger is adequate. Although so Woody Allen by numbers that you'll already have a pretty good idea of what's going on long before it happens, which makes the experience of watching it somewhat pointless. To my surprise, it's not completely unenjoyable, largely due to the decent performances, and I don't find it anything like as reprehensible as its almost universally negative reviews would suggest, but it's by no means the most memorable film that I've seen this year. There's enough flaws to present to prevent recommending it to anyone but the most diehard of Woody Allen films, and, well, these days even that's a pretty guarded recommendation, Woody Allen having long since gone downhill, and I didn't think he was starting off from that high up the hill, to be honest with you. Yeah, so I would give this one a body swerve.
A comedy in which people give themselves mental health issues. It's all fun and games until someone loses a mind. So then that brings us on to Attack the Block. Around here we likes us some Cornballs and Dr. Buckles, but it is with mixed emotions that we receive Joe Cornish's directorial debut Attack the Block. For while an exciting development in and of itself, it perhaps signals the end of a beautiful broadcasting relationship. Drew, is this something to worry about, or is it something to rejoice in?
On the strength of this film, I would say he ought not to give up his day job.
Aye?
Oh, his weekend job, I suppose, really.
Mm.
Yeah, it's a bit disappointing. It's also suffering from the fact that the trailer seems to suggest that it's a comedy, which it's definitely, definitely not, which kind of threw me for a while. And I think perhaps if it had been a comedy, it'd have been a better film. It had been to sort of the Assault on Precinct 13 type film, what Shaun of the Dead was to zombie films.
Scott, is this something to rejoice in?
Well, I wanted very much to like the film, mainly because of the people behind it. But, we'll get on to that later. It's set in the tough council schemes of Lan-Lan, this centering on a group of hoodies, young thugs interrupted from their usual entertainment of mugging people when an alien lands close to them. True to form, they stave its head in, or whatever it had that was in place of its head. However, their triumphalism is short-lived, as the relatively small and harmless creature they oft is chased by a large number of its elder, angrier compadres, all gunning for the crew of Moses, Pest, Dennis, Jerome, and Biggs. I don't know why Dennis didn't get one of these cool nicknames. It seems a bit unfair.
Well, his real name's actually Frank, so Dennis seems quite cool.
Also mixed up in this chaos is a nurse, played Sam, played by Jodie Whittaker, who's a victim of that there bugging, what I done spoke of. Block dope dealer Ron, played by Nick Frost. One of his customers, the hapless, misplaced, middle-class student-type Bruce, and the crime lord bigwig of the tower block, Hi-Hats, mistakenly believing this perturbance is Mosey's attempt to usurp him from his role. I think it's mainly my own fault that I didn't enjoy Attack the Block, and I'm not sure where I got this idea from, been expecting it to be a comedy. It's not deadly serious piece of filmmaking, and there's a few funny moments in it, but this is very far from being an out-and-out comedy. It's pitched somewhere between Alien and Assault on Precinct 13, although with a particularly unlikely set of heroes. It mixes action, chase, siege mentalities, and presents an interesting mix of genres. The language is also remarkable, this bizarre neo-London patois that's about a million miles away from Cockney and also a million miles away from any other understandable form of English. Although that said, I mean, from the context, everything's remarkably clear. It's perhaps understandable why American distributors might be put off by the language, but I think they're worrying over nothing. Few in Britain could speak this slang, but it does remain comprehensible throughout. The problem is with them, their unlikely heroes, what I done spoke of. The delinquent robbers are, by their very nature, unlikable, and this is the film's grand gamble to feature genuinely unsympathetic protagonists, with, I suppose, the understanding that the gradual realisation of their personal responsibility over the course of the piece allows us to eventually be brought on side with them. But I don't see it myself as everyone's just as much of a thug at the end of it as they are at the start, and realising past actions are immoral hardly excuses them. There are impressive elements, for sure. Cornish gets a range of good performances across the cast, and the framing, pacing, editing, shot selection, all the other mechanical aspects of the film are well handled, and probably better handled than you'd expect from a first-time feature director. The effects are surprisingly effective, a horrible sentence, given the film's budget, and they generally don't look as cheap as you might expect from a small UK indie flick about space invaders. The aliens themselves remind me of the aliens drawn on the side of the old space invaders cabinet, actually, which didn't have any relation to the aliens in the game. I digress. I just couldn't engage with the film. I wouldn't say I found it unenjoyable. It just made very little impact on me. I mean, the more...
Is the problem perhaps the expectational? Because obviously...
Well, that's what I'm thinking. I mean, the more I'm thinking of it, I'm sure I'm doing a disservice to it, purely because I expected something different to what it actually is.
Yeah,
and I'm sure when I listen to this in about a year or so, I'll come back to it and I'll feel foolish for having said such things, having watched it again and maybe revised my opinion. But from where I am at the minute, no, I just can't recommend it. It just didn't make any impact on me at all, one way or the other.
Joe Cornish is a funny man who's made a good living out of being funny. And, I mean, I haven't seen the film, but I would expect it to be a comedy, because all the marketing I've seen for it seems to centre quite heavily on the, well, obviously it's kind of, there's a horror element there, but most of the marketing seems to make it seem quite lightweight and a bit jokey, and, you know, I would go in expecting it to be a horror comedy.
Yeah, that's definitely the impression the trailer gives you. And there's other things too, apart from Joe Cornish, sort of how you'd expect it to be funny just because it was him. They look at things like executive produced by Edgar Wright, mm. where you're thinking, well, then it's a comedy, right? And but it's not. But there's all these other things, and just the marketing not helping it, that makes you think that. And I think Scott may have something that, certainly because for quite a chunk of that film, I was expecting to get funnier. No, it's not going to then. And it really sort of sets you off wrong to be expecting something from a film that isn't that. It also has the problem, again, as Scott said, of having really unlikable protagonists. And it starts off the sort of typical Daily Mail nightmare. You've got this group of young thugs, all bar one of whom is black, who attack the nice white nurse. And it's all, I was rather afraid it was going to turn to Cherry Tree Lane at the start. And you see some suggestion later on of, particularly for the main character, Moses, of what might have been a contributing factor to his becoming a delinquent, but those are reasons, not excuses, and what he's done is still wrong. So it's still very hard to buy into the character later on when you know he's been an unpleasant, dangerous, violent thug from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I am not sure whether I would find it better again if I watched it, but I think that I see enough promise that I'd want to give it a go. I'd have to wait a good long time, but again, like, so I couldn't recommend it either. Just, I didn't completely dislike it, but I was just sort of watching, it's like, okay, this is there, and there were a couple of funny bits, but then it ended and didn't really create a great deal of emotion in me one way or the other.
That's disappointing. Well, there you go then. That's another roundup over and done with. We will be back soon enough with, I think, a review of 13 Assassins as a header to a sort of Takashi Miike retrospective, would you call it, Scott?
Oh, I hope so.
Oh, yeah. But that won't be until a certain Mr. Morris gets his ass back from somewhere far nicer than the UK. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. Yeah. or thereabouts. Take it or leave it, I don't care. I was Craig, Drew was Drew.
Fairly well.
Doing it again. And Scott was Scott.
Goodbye.
Take care. Bye.